On the phone, I have Jeanette Fitzsimons of the New Zealand Green Party. Kia ora and good morning, Jeanette.
Kia ora, Tim.
Jeanette, thank you for coming on. I realise you're very busy, but can you tell our listeners about your State of the Planet speech and how you aim to get New Zealanders behind the green vision?
Well, thanks. That's a tall order, Tim. Most politicians or political leaders make a State of the Nation speech about once a year. The Greens have decided that what we actually need is a State of the Planet speech, because it's not just about what's happening in New Zealand, it's what's happening on the whole of the Earth. And this is the second year that I've done a State of the Planet speech. And I use it to draw attention to the really big issues like climate change, like the ecological collapse of the oceans and New Zealand's role in that, like the approaching end of cheap oil, the phenomenon we call peak oil, which is going to make oil very much more expensive in the future, and the changes that that requires for our way of life. This time I talked a little bit about the peculiar situation where we've decided as a society that there's a goal that is even more important than happiness or survival or protecting the planet or spending time with our children or any of the other things that are really important to us. And this overall goal, which is sometimes called progress, is about economic growth. And it's actually economic growth, which we now expect to increase at about 4% every year. Like, the economy gets bigger by 4% every year, more resources, more money changing hands. It's that growth in the economy which is creating the challenges to our climate, to our oil resources, to our oceans, to our environment. And it doesn't actually seem to be making us any happier. We're busy working away extra long hours, draining and polluting our fresh waters, sending species to extinction, killing 400 New Zealanders a year with air pollution, clearing forests and wetlands, straightening and damming rivers, paving over food-producing land just for this economic growth. And yet the research shows that it actually isn't making us any happier, it's making us more miserable. We've now got a fifth of New Zealanders who are suffering at some stage of their lives from clinical depression. That's a huge number, and it affects women and Māori the most. The World Health Organization says that by 2020, depression will be the second highest cause of death and disability in the world. And it affects rich people as well as poor people. So obviously being rich doesn't protect you from depression and all the misery that goes with that. So I looked into some of the literature that's been over the years about what is the connection between wealth and happiness. And it seems that what matters to people is relative wealth rather than absolute wealth, which makes sense. For the people, for the poorest people in New Zealand, clearly their happiness is going to be improved if they have better incomes. But for most people in New Zealand, it isn't going to be. We've certainly got some poverty in New Zealand, and we do have to deal with that. But actually, as our economic growth has increased, it's not those people who've got the benefit. We've had huge increases in the salary packages of CEOs, like 27% in a year increase in salary packages for chief executives. And the poorest people's wages and salaries haven't even kept pace with inflation. So the gap is getting larger. And we know from the social science research that the bigger the gap is between the rich and the poor, the more unhappy our society is. In 1987, wages were over 48% of our total national income, and profits were just over 40%. But now we've reversed those. And profits are now 45% and wages only 42.5%. So the ordinary worker's share of the economy has got less over the last 9 years or so, and the share held by the wealthiest people has got greater.
How does the Green Party intend to to even out things in this whole process?
Well, I don't think you can do it other than by changing aspirations. And that starts with a kind of wake-up call. That starts with more and more people having the experience, oh, more money isn't actually making me happier. Well, if you look at what people do on holiday, for example, they battle to leave behind all the goods that they have worked really, really hard to accumulate, and they go and live a simpler life somewhere. You know, they don't take their double carports and their two bathrooms and their heated tile rails and their plasma TVs with them. They go off with a tent or to stay in a cabin or on a little boat close to the sea and the mountains and the forest, camping and tramping and sailing and kayaking and just hanging out at the beach looking at the sunset. It's a hankering after less material stuff and more real experiences. And if I think a lot of people are starting to realise that if those are the things that matter to them, then working more hours in order to get more stuff and damaging our health, damaging our relationships with our families, damaging the upbringing of our children is actually not going to work. I really think you're only going to get a change in what people do when more people start to understand that that is not the route to happiness. And that is starting to happen, particularly in developed countries. A large number of people now, if they're asked, given a choice between more free time or more money, which would you choose? More and more people are saying, well, actually, more free time, because there's a lot of things I want to do that my job doesn't allow me to do at the moment. And that less stuff and more free time is a big part of what will heal the planet as we stop pursuing this relentless dollar that requires more and more resources, more and more energy, and more pollution, and start valuing the things that don't use a lot of resources, like time with our families, tramping and kayaking, listening to music, all the other things that people do that really makes their lives richer and more worthwhile.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because everybody has been sort of encouraged constantly by the media who want growth, 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 because the corporates need to have their shareholders are constantly wanting more profit. It's a very difficult.
Well, we're not going to get any help from the mainstream media in challenging the value system of our consumer society, because the media are funded through advertising revenues, and advertising revenue pushes consumption. And you get more advertising revenue when the economy is growing fast and corporates are spending more and more money asking you to buy their stuff. So it's going to have to be done. I mean, to the extent that any media will help, it will be networks like yours, which is not part of the corporate mainstream. And otherwise, it's going to be done person to person and in community groups. You know, we're not ever going to have TV One News advocating buying less stuff.
Zero growth. I agree.
And of course, there are some things that should grow, and this is not an anti-growth thing so much as the be-all and end-all of life should not be growth in the economy. It should be growth in the things we need more of and shrinkage of the things that we need less of. So we need to aim our economy at growing things like solar and wind energy and low emission transport, public transport, rail, organic farming, diverse species forestry. Like, there's a lot of things that it would be really good to grow. It would be good to grow an industry in wind-assisted shipping, for example, so that we can still get things around the world when we don't have much oil. But that should be accompanied by some shrinkage in the things that aren't actually doing us any good and that are wrecking the planet. And if the overall sum total of everything doesn't grow at all, but we've grown the things that matter and shrunk the things that don't, then we should still all be better off.
Yes, because you've been circulating a document recently, of course, Turn Down the Heat, outlining details of the goals and practical measures New Zealand needs to undertake to meet its Kyoto protocols, and, of course, the general moral obligation to reduce the impact of greenhouse gas emissions and slow the already apparent impact of harmful climate disruption. Are you getting agreements slowly within Parliament from the other parties to be able to support you? Because they must be wisening up to what's happening. Slowly?
We did have the Minister of responsible for climate change issues, Pete Hodgson, refer to our Turn Down the Heat document very positively at the big climate change conference we've just had in Wellington, and that was helpful support. It is, I think, bizarre that only one party in a parliament of eight parties has got a climate change policy at the moment. National doesn't have one at all. It just really denies the whole issue. Labor did have one, but abandoned it last December and is now rethinking it, and is going to take another year rethinking it before it has a policy. And for the other parties, it's mostly not on their radar screen. So there has been quite a lot of support from commentators, the public, and some business groups. Foresters particularly can see the sense of what we're advocating. And so, yes, there's certainly a view building quite strongly out among the public that it's not good enough to do nothing, that Treasury's advice that we should just sit back and buy carbon credits in 2012 to make up for our pollution is a daft idea. If we're going to spend money as a country on complying with climate change objectives, for goodness sake, let's spend it paying New Zealanders to clean up their act and invest in renewables rather than paying Russia to buy credits to let us off the hook for polluting. In Parliament, I think, well, the big call that came out of the conference was that we need a cross-party consensus on what we should do about climate change. Now, you're never going to get political parties who oppose each other agreeing on a policy to deal with climate change, because political parties are about differentiating views and then arguing for which one is best. But I think we could actually get agreement on some basic things that would still allow parties to differentiate. If we could get agreement on just three things, I think that would be a huge move forward, and it would be very good for business, because it would give business the stability and the certainty to invest, knowing that the whole scene wasn't going to change again with the next election. And those three things are: we should agree that climate change is real and that it's serious. Secondly, we should agree that there isn't a lot of time and it is urgent to take some action. And thirdly, we should try to agree that that action must include there being a price on carbon. Business is going to respond to pricing signals, and so are a lot of ordinary citizens. You're not going to get your whole economy shift just through altruism or voluntary behaviour. If business knows that regardless of whether it's a carbon tax or emissions trading or an offsets policy or some other kind of mechanism, whatever the mechanism is, that it is going to cost money to put carbon into the atmosphere, then they will invest in things that put less carbon into the atmosphere and know that they'll be ahead. The real disaster with the axing of the carbon charge in December was that businesses that had started to prepare for a world in which it cost more to emit carbon suddenly find themselves disadvantaged, and other businesses which have done nothing are sort of laughing. So it is important that we get that stability for business, and if we could get parties just to agree on those three things, they'd still be free to argue about how we get there, what's the best thing to do, do you have energy efficiency standards as well, do you have a trading policy or do you have a carbon charge. That wouldn't matter, because you'd know that even if those policies changed, you would still have a world in which it cost to emit carbon and that investments made to reduce carbon emissions would be worthwhile.
What is clean burning coal?
Well, there's a lot of confusion and obfuscation being created in the coal industry. There is something called clean coal, although I would call it cleaner coal rather than clean coal. And its process is to burn the coal without putting out the sulfur and the oxides of nitrogen and the soot, which fouls the air and makes it hard for people to breathe. And they have cleaned up coal burning quite a lot in those respects. But that technology makes absolutely no difference to the carbon dioxide emissions, which are the climate-changing emissions. So cleaner coal will help prevent local smog and respiratory disease, but it won't do anything for the climate. To make coal clean from a climate point of view, you've got to somehow make the technology work to take the carbon dioxide out of the exhaust gases and process it to pipe the carbon dioxide to somewhere where you can store it forever, where it won't get out. Now, that's a pretty hard thing to do. It's been achieved on a small scale at a technical level, but at enormous cost. Ways they're looking at it is that one of the first ideas was, let's pump it into the very bottom of the deep ocean and it'll be absorbed by the sea. Well, that idea has lost favour recently, as we've discovered that half of all the carbon dioxide that's been put out since we started burning fossil fuels hasn't gone into the atmosphere at all. If it had, we'd be facing much more serious climate change already than we are. It's gone into the ocean, and it's made the ocean more acid, because you dissolve carbon dioxide, you get weak carbonic acid, and that is putting at risk all the marine creatures that use calcium to form their shells. So krill, shellfish, crustacean, coral reefs. And the acidification of the oceans is a real ecological threat, so we don't want to make that one worse. Then they say, well, that one of the most popular ideas is, let's put it down old gas fields where we've extracted the natural gas, but we know the gas stayed down there for thousands of years without leaking out, so we can now put the CO2 down there and hold it in the gas field forever. But I've spoken, for one thing, there's only a certain number of those fields available. They're not necessarily very close to where you want to burn the carbon, and so you've got long transport distances. And mining geologists have said to me that when you finish mining a gas field and you put a concrete plug into the hole, it doesn't fit perfectly, and also the concrete is likely to be eaten away by the acidity. So you cannot guarantee that the carbon dioxide will stay down there permanently. It might stay for 10 or 20 years, and then just as we expect to be getting climate change under control, suddenly we find that CO2 levels in the air are going up again, and we realise it's all leaking out from gas fields. Well, what do you do at that stage? You've really had it. A third idea might be a bit more workable, and that is to dissolve it in very deep, salty aquifers, way below the water table that anybody uses. But whatever you do, this is an enormously expensive process. It's not going to trap all the carbon, and if our use of coal goes on increasing, if we double our economy every couple of decades or so, eventually we're going to get back to the point where even if we've captured 85% of the carbon from coal-fired power stations, that 15% is going to have multiplied up till we're back where we started. So in my view, we've got to go for much greater energy efficiency, we've got to go for renewable forms of energy, and we've got to bypass the coal age.
You talk about hopefully putting a fully renewable electricity generating system in by 2027. That's a long way away.
When I worked out how to get there, I was disappointed it was so far away. But at the moment, the proportion of our electricity that comes from renewables is reducing every year. Most people don't realise that. They see us building wind farms and they think, oh, we're getting more renewable. But actually, we're not. Because we're building fossil faster than we're building wind. And so the non-renewable, the climate-changing part of our electricity system is getting bigger rather than smaller. So I worked on the basis that we slow demand with greater efficiency, to 1% a year instead of 2%, and then we increase renewables by 2% a year, which 1% of which caters for all the increased demand, and the other percent of which starts backing out the coal. By 2027, we get to a 100% renewable system. So while it seems slow, it is actually quite a challenge even to do it that fast. But I was going for things that seem to be practical, and I believe that's a practical target if New Zealand wants to take it on.
And what about the idea of every home and business having a solar hot water system, bearing in mind Germany is going full on with this, and they're higher up in the latitude so than New Zealand. So why not we go into a sort of a semi-war footing and get businesses behind producing solar hot water systems for every home and business?
Well, I'm a strong advocate for solar hot water, but we've got to recognise that it's not going to do the job on its own. It's a part of the solution, but it's not a huge part. I still think it's really worth doing, and the problem at the moment is that solar water heaters are still very expensive. It takes quite a few years to pay off the capital investment through the electricity savings, and there's all sorts of barriers, like people don't think they'll be in their home long enough to actually pay them off, and they're not sure that they'll get any recognition of the value of that solar water heater when they sell their home. There aren't enough competently trained installers around, and we still get some people putting them in badly. There's not enough information about the market. Councils charge absolutely outrageous prices for building consents to put them in. That can add $600 to the price of your solar water heater. And so I'm working currently with the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Authority on ways to overcome those barriers, and I'm hoping that by the end of this year we'll have a scheme starting to increase the rate at which they are installed. It's not a trivial problem, but yes, that is one of the things we can do.
Yes, because I thought that with a lot of production happening, the price would come down immensely.
Yes, but you've got to have the demand first. So we've got a lot of people who say, I would definitely buy a solar water heater if they were cheaper, but they're not cheaper. And then you've got suppliers saying, well, we could perhaps bring our price down if we got a bulk order for a lot of solar water heaters, but they haven't got a bulk order. And the question is, how do you bring those two together and get the bulk orders on condition the price comes down, and get the price down on condition there are bulk orders? So that's the sort of issue that we're working with.
Yes, government loans and government rebates, and the government turning around and saying, right, we want to be able to, if it's so serious, the government might say, look, we're just going to pass some sort of legislation that allows people to all get a solar hot water system on their house, because 35% of electricity supposedly goes into heating hot water in the house. So,
that's right.
Yeah, big one, Jeanette. And can I talk a little bit about carbon storage payments regarding penalties for deforesting? New Zealand trees now, we're not planting as many forests as we're used to. From what I gather, there's been a slackening of tree growth. I mean, admittedly, it's monoculture, but is monoculture better than nothing?
Well, in terms of carbon, yes, it is. What we'd like to see is much more diversity in the kinds of forests that are planted, longer-lived species, forests that are then logged sustainably on a annual growth rate basis, where the closed canopy and you take out small areas or individual trees and you let it grow some more. All of that. We certainly need a lot more forests on our steep, badly eroding hill country. We need more forest in places where we have terrible risk of flooding to slow down the water and hold the soil together. We need forests for biodiversity. We need forests for carbon. And so far, New Zealanders have expected forestry companies to provide all those additional benefits for free. And maybe they could when the price of timber overseas was very high, but it's not now, and pine forestry in New Zealand is very, very marginally profitable, if at all, at the moment. And so people are not planting more forests, and they're actually cutting down half-grown pine trees and burning them to convert to farming. And farming, of course, not only doesn't store the carbon in the trees, but if you're running cattle or sheep, it produces methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas as well. I was up climbing Maungatauturi Mountain in the Waikato over Easter and could see huge areas of smoke, which I was told was Land Corp converting partly mature pine plantations to dairy farms in the South Waikato Northern Volcanic Plateau. And, I mean, you just would make you cry to look at it, the amount of carbon going up in smoke, literally, and then all the methane emissions there will be from those cattle and the effects on the waterways of that area by intensifying animal production. So there needs to be a payment for the benefits that people create by planting trees. There needs to be some recognition to foresters for carbon storage and for soil and water conservation, and then we'll see forestry increase, and that's part of what we're advocating in turning down the heat.